were attacked on 9/11, there were not soldiers standing up saying, hey, we were attacked by Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Libya, and Egypt. That must mean Iraq's the central front of the war on terror. And my simple thing to say here is support the troops. Support their safe return and their being used properly to defend the country and the Constitution, because that's what we signed up for. We did not sign up to be used as gunboat diplomats in an arbitrary war.
Me to feel I'm falling, I am falling, the lights go out.
Welcome to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. I'm Mark Steiner, and that's Thomas Young. He's a 26-year-old veteran of the Iraq War, who's paralyzed from the chest down. He was shot in Iraq on April 4th, 2004. He'd only been in country 5 days. Now, you were 18 when you went in?
I went in at the age of 17 to look for college money, because my family was not going to be able to afford to pay for me to go there myself. So I figured instead of looking for Pell Grants and Stafford loans and things, I'd go ahead and enlist and try to get college money that way. Unfortunately, I was medically discharged due to tendonitis in the shoulders, but was told that I could re-enlist after a period of 2 years. Had no plans to ever revisit an Army life, but September 11th happened, and that I was 22 at that point. And so after I sat there riveted and watched the whole thing all day, and two or three days later, I saw George Bush reliving out his glory days as a Yale cheerleader with the megaphone in his hand, talking about going to smoke the evildoers out of their caves and bring them to justice. And as I've been prone to saying, I guess I've watched too many crime dramas on TV, because I figured you'd go after the evidence and chase the bad guys. Another example I've been using is on December 8th, 1941, we didn't set plans to go about and attack the Chinese, because they had a similar complexion to the people that actually attacked us. And the only way I knew to react was to re-enlist and defend my country and its constitution from being under attack.
Thomas is at the center of a new documentary film called Body of War, produced and directed by veteran journalist and TV host Phil Donahue and filmmaker Ellen Spiro. Phil met Thomas when Thomas was a patient at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Phil Donahue wasn't sure where to take the story from there.
I went to the Media Reform Conference in St. Louis. And on the way home, I'm sitting next to a woman by the name of D.D. Halleck, who is a longtime progressive voice. And I'm saying, I met this kid at Walter Reed, and I don't know what to. I just feel that we should see him. You know, is it possible I could make a movie? And she gets out her laptop, bip, 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 on the airplane, you know, and she gives me Mobilis Media, Austin, Texas, and female voice answered the phone, and thank God she recognized me. That was, you know, speed bump one. I got past. And we had a blind date. It was really blind, you know. I mean, she knew me from TV, but hell, she didn't know me. And I didn't, you know, I saw her work and I thought it was wonderful, but I didn't know, you know, what kind of person she was. So it was a leap of faith for both of us, really. We go to Kansas City, we go off to see Thomas, and boy, Ellen just bought this story right now.
In part, this film is an intimate and raw look at the reality of Thomas's life. He struggles to manage his myriad health problems and adjust to this world in this new body. The film is no holds barred, especially in its depiction of very private personal issues that Thomas contends with on a daily basis. I mean, when you made this documentary with Phil Donahue and Ellen Spiro, you obviously made a decision to kind of allow your life to be exposed, literally and figuratively, to the world. But talk a bit about that, how you felt about that, and why you did that.
Well, I mean, at the very beginning of the process, I was mindful. I minded my P's and Q's, or at least I tried to. But eventually, as the filming went on, I came to the idea that the more the viewer sees about my daily life and what I go through, I hope they'll consider the ramifications and consequences of making rash decisions to enlist out of a certain patriotic feeling, examine the evidence, find out what was going on. As I've said before, if I had had Dionne Warwick's psychic friends on a speed dial and she could have told me that what was going to happen, I might not have joined. And likewise, if I had been shot and paralyzed in Afghanistan, where I felt the fight was valid, there would be no body of war. You and I would not be speaking. I would take my government money, go home, and shut the hell up.
But that isn't what happened. And because he feels that he was disabled in a fight that was invalid and unjust, Thomas speaks out against the war and lets the audience into intensely private moments. In this scene, Thomas's mother, Kathy, helps him insert a catheter into his penis.
I can urinate. I can push out urine, but I don't push it all out. A lot of it still stays stored in my bladder. And so the reason for the catheting is to insert a catheter into my penis to drain out that excess urine. Because if it's kept in there, it will crystallize and harden and play part in urinary tract infections.
Okay, what do I need to do?
All right. I'm going to lift up and you're going to sit that under me.
Okay.
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 Right. Oh, this is hard to do from this angle. Can you help me out here, Mom?
Yeah.
Must be hard to do. I may need to change those. Okay, now in this bag, you're going to take this lube out.
Okay.
Instead of lubing up the end of that, you're going to lube the head of the penis.
Okay.
Because it uses less lube. You're just going to lube right over the hole.
Like that?
And now, you know, you're just going to insert the catheter. And I really kind of wanted you to put the glove on the hand that was going to put the catheter in. But, okay. You seriously can push it in a little quicker than that one.
No, I can't.
Are you nervous?
Yeah.
Oh.
I've never done this before.
Okay.
Is it coming out?
Yeah, it's coming out.
Oh.
Hey, Mom. We generally tend to watch what goes on up there.
I'm trying to move it so it doesn't just go everywhere.
Good plan. I saw that worked swimmingly. Look at that. You got pee on your hand.
I know. You know what? It's not the first time I've had your pee on my hand.
You made a film, the two of you, that was very graphic in its depiction of what it's like to be a paraplegic. From catheters coming in his penis to talking about erection to all the other emotional issues he felt as a man in a wheelchair. I mean, and you were really graphic. This was not like no holds barred in many ways when it came to describing what his life was like. I mean, A, I'm interested in that effect on you and also how Thomas felt about having his life laid out there like that.
Well, Phil was very committed to showing his truth, his reality, and that the bodily functions were part of that story. And if you see someone in a wheelchair, you don't think about everything else that's going on. But because we were able to spend a lot of time with Thomas, he became more comfortable and he began to see the reason why it would be good to show certain things. But we also filmed those things that, you know, you refer to as so graphic, at times where Thomas or in his mother in one scene are in control. So they've reached the point where they can actually laugh about this stuff. So you've got a very tragic thing going on, but you've got humor too. And that's where Thomas can transcend any blow that's dealt to him, is that he's hysterically funny. I mean,
he's
I knew
very funny.
On our first visit to see him when he said to me, you know, soldiers voting for Bush is like chickens voting for Colonel Sanders, you know, and he was all doped up on 1,000 drugs, but he still had this wit and humor. So there's that part of the film, too, that lifts us up from the tragic moments.
It isn't just Thomas's personal and sometimes tragic private moments that we're witness to. Thomas's mother, Kathy, sent her oldest son off to war. He came home a paraplegic. And now her middle son, Nathan, is about to go to Iraq for the first time.
These 21, 22-year-olds that are leaving, it's not even in their heads that they're going to come back dead. They don't even think about that. They're just going over to there, shoot people, and they're going to shoot everything that's in their way. And if they do that, a bullet's not going to hit them. You know? If they shoot the Iraqis first, those roadside bombs aren't going to blow them up. And that's the mentality that the Army has to have and has to use to get these kids to go over there. I mean, this is all just a waste. I mean, what they're training for, because that's not what they're going to do. They're not going to rappel off shit. There's nothing to rappel off of over there. They're not going to drop out of helicopters, and it's not going to be all glamorous and shit. And it's so hard to be here getting ready to send Nathan off. And I mean, I want him to know how proud I am of him and how brave he is, but I don't want him to be brave. I don't want him to be a hero. I don't want him to think that I'm so proud of him because he's a hero. I'd be just as proud of him if he worked at Target and made $6 an hour. And it pisses me off that it has to be like this, that this has to be the way it is, for them to be brave and be honorable and, you know. This makes them better. This makes them dead.
Thomas's mother, Kathy, is in this situation where she has Thomas, who's come home from Iraq paralyzed from the chest down. She has another son, Nathan, who's in our film, who gets deployed to Iraq during the course of our film. So she's seeing one son go off to war while this other son has come home. And it's an interesting family because it really is a microcosm of the whole country. We've got red and blue in this one family. You've got a stepfather and a brother who are gung-ho, pro-Bush, pro-military. And you have Thomas and his mom whose feelings have changed because of this particular war. And But Thomas's mother really is an incredible balancer of these two elements.
Because she's still married to the guy that's referred to as a ditto head in the film. Despite the fact that Kathy actively fights against this Iraq war, she's married to a man who supports the war. It almost seems unfair that this woman, with a son paralyzed in the war, should have to defend her anti-war stance to her husband.
The focus turned to one mother's grief.
He's on vacation here for 5 weeks.
There's your buddy.
She's there because she's our voice.
Yeah, she's your voice, not my voice.
No, when I meant our, I meant mothers of children who are in Iraq. My husband's very right-wing,
a very conservative Republican ditto head. She says she wants to talk to the president. He believes in Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and God forbid Hannity, and he's very pro-Bush. He thinks Bush is wonderful.
Yeah, he's a president. He doesn't need to talk to a woman that is
given
way out there on the fringe.
That has given everything for this country.
She didn't give anything. Her son did.
Right. She gave her son.
I like that they're called ditto heads because when you make a copy, it's called a ditto, essentially. So you just take what he says and go, yep, and you make a carbon copy of it in your brain, and that's what you tell people. Yeah. But their marriage has survived because I guess in relationships, as in magnetics, opposites tend to attract. But my stepdad's political ideologies aside, he still stands behind me for standing up for something I believe in. And he supports my my mom and my kid brother, and which is a lot more than I can say for any other man that has come into my family's life. He takes care of my mom and my little brother, so I love him for it, regardless of how we see politics.
That's good, man. I like that. So how is your little brother?
The one in Iraq or the little one?
The littlest one, yeah.
He at times can be quite the spitfire. He's a very energetic kid who marches completely not just to one drummer but a whole damn rhythm section. He goes his own way, but unfortunately right now my mom has both my brother and my own a Department of Defense photo to take of you in basic training. She has them both framed on the wall, and he has said many times that he can't wait to get his picture up on the wall next to ours. So I got 9 years to make sure that he understands that he needs to do that safely and responsibly. If this war in Iraq is still going on when he's old enough to serve, I will lock him up in my basement to keep him from going to Iraq.
But other than that, you don't mind him serving?
No, I consider the military to be a very valid and honorable thing, noble and honorable thing to do when it's used right. Defending the country and its constitution is one of the greatest things we can do as Americans. But when you volunteer and are used in the complete wrong way under fabricated evidence, I can understand how it would drive enlistment numbers down. But defending the country is a great thing when you're actually called upon to defend the country and not be used as gunboat diplomats.
What about your brother Nathan, who's been there twice, right? And
he is over there right now on his again? Second on his on second deployment. He's scheduled to come back sometime around the end of the year, unless the Bush administration has already said that that's pretty much what's going to happen. So, and he's looking forward to getting out once he gets home. He's been stop lost, as many of our soldiers have. And which, by the way, conveniently enough, was not a practice that was around in Vietnam, because who knows how many more tours John McCain would have had to do after he came back. He's been stop lost. He's ready to get out. He realizes, and as I've heard a lot of people over there, they have no idea what the hell they're fighting for. They're there to worry about their friend to the left and to the right, and themselves. Self-preservation is the main key that drives many of the soldiers there.
That self-preservation is a little difficult to maintain once they get home. Tens of thousands of returning Iraqi War veterans are in need of serious physical and mental health care. The Veterans Administration and the veteran systems in this country are not ready to take care of what this war has caused. In the documentary, Thomas meets Bobby Muller, a disabled Vietnam War veteran who heads Vietnam Veterans of America, and he draws a strong contrast between the care he received 30 years ago and what Thomas is receiving now on his return from Iraq.
When you got shot, what was it like?
All of a sudden, my body just went completely numb. I couldn't feel anything. I dropped my M16. I tried to pick it back up, but I couldn't move my hands.
Where'd you get shot?
Right underneath the left collarbone.
That's where I got shot. Bullet came here and went through the spinal cord as it went out. Mm-hmm. So we got the angle and the trajectories were a little bit different, but we got similar things.
Shortly after that, I was out for about a week. Woke up in Walter Reed Army Hospital, and that was where they kind of started to do a little rehab with me. I had a physical and an occupational therapist. They would come and they'd take me out of my bed and put me in this weird chair and just leave me there for 2 hours. That was my physical therapy at the very beginning.
How long were you in the hospital?
A week and a half in Germany, a month, about 2.5-3 months, separated over different hospitals.
I was in the hospital for a year. And then I went on an outpatient basis for another 9 months. You got short shrift, you know. I think I'm in better condition than you are.
Oh, yeah.
All right? Can you sit up easily enough?
I can sit up easily enough, but it gets very painful to maintain an up position.
Why? Where does it hurt?
It hurts all the way. It hurts in my neck, and it radiates to my shoulders and upper back. It stops about the chest level where I'm paralyzed from.
You need work, man. Again, I'm just going to say it. I think you got short shrift, man. You've seen the squandering of, you know, billions of dollars for bullshit war, destroying people. You get shot, and now they're going to skimp on giving you the kind of treatment and care that, you know, you obviously have a right to and deserve. I got to the point where I said, okay, here it is. if I don't fight this system, I will die. You got every right in the world to say, this is bullshit. You know, what are they going to do to you? What are they going to do to you?
What struck me was, when they had this conversation, was that on the one hand, we have this technology, medical technology, that kept 28,000 men and women alive who were injured in Iraq. But we haven't moved far enough in the Veterans Administration to take care of the men and women who were hurt better than or perhaps worse than we did during Vietnam. That was startling.
Yeah.
What Bobby Mueller said, that was startling.
Yeah, we agree.
Yeah, because we have the sense that Vietnam veterans were treated, you know, like less than human beings. And now we have Iraq veterans coming home, and they're being treated worse than the Vietnam veterans. I mean, there's a huge number of homeless people, mentally ill people. And Thomas, I mean, even though he had the film crew following him around, as Bobby said, got short shrift. You know, he did not get the care that he needed. And when we arrived at his house, his care, you know, consisted of piles and piles and piles of medications, not the real treatment, the physical therapy, the stuff that he needed.
My pill box separates them out for the week. This is carbamazepine. It is a nerve pain medication. This is a drug called Coumadin, and it's a blood thinner. This is tizanidine. It's an antispasm medication. This is gabapentin. It's a nerve pain medication. This is bupropion. It's an antidepressant. This is omeprazole. It's for morning nausea. And this is morphine. It's a narcotic. And in this situation, the effect is not to get high, but to kill pain. And so I have to take more and more of it to stop the pain.
I don't think America really understands how little we're caring for these veterans coming back.
Well, you know, it's all rhetoric. These are words. Oh, the troops, the brave troops, the courageous troops, our brave. I mean, it goes on and on. And the troops come home, and the VA doesn't call them back. I mean, this is the ultimate hypocrisy.
And if Thomas likes to say that if you want to do something to support the troops, go down to your local homeless shelter and volunteer, because you'll find a lot of them there.
When you talked to Bobby Mueller and he was saying to you that you need to get better treatment, you need to kind of take hold of things, what's happened since the film and your treatment and you physically? Have you?
Well, it's very interesting. Over the past couple months, For some reason, I can't quite put my finger on it. I myself have been receiving better care. Maybe it's because I have a documentary coming out. and I asked about that. I asked some people from the VA, and they've told me that there is now better oversight in taking care of veterans and making sure claims are processed quickly and things of that sort. And although I have been lied to by the VA several times before, all I really have to say is that if that's the case, then it would be about high time to, as they say, lift that veil of secrecy, because I hear all the time that news crews are having trouble getting in to film stories about the VA. And considering the way the government and the Bush administration has been, in my opinion, quite fairly derided for its mistakes and shortcomings, I would think they would like to be quick to point out any areas where they might be improving. So if that's the case, then news crews and cameras should be allowed to film the VA getting better instead of not being allowed to watch it stay the same.
As we watch Thomas battle with his physical limitations, we also watch as he and his new bride, Bree, struggle to keep their marriage alive. It's a challenge familiar to the families of many veterans of the Iraq War.
If this war in Iraq is not going to end anytime in the near foreseeable future, they cannot send my brothers and sisters over there 3, 4, 5 times to disrupt not only their personal lives and psychic well-beings, but also that of their families, their husbands, wives, and children, because as I recently discovered during the filming of my of the documentary, divorce is definitely one of the unseen casualties of war that is happening in homes all across the country, whether those veterans be injured severely or not. There certainly are psychiatric turmoils that a veteran goes through that some marriages are not strong enough to withstand.
Many returning veterans and their spouses have reported troubles in their marriages since their return from Iraq. Thomas and Bree had the added difficulty of the challenges brought on by his disability.
I do a lot of nursing care for Thomas, and I've heard a lot of people say that that can get in the way of your intimacy.
I'm cleaning out his puke pan. He gets nauseous a lot, especially in the mornings.
When we are fighting, he will sometimes get angry and say we're basically roommates and that I'm, you know, his housekeeper and his maid. I could count on my hand, one hand, how many times we've had sex. And then obviously when you're spending a lot of time in bed and you can't easily get up and go get things, you have a lot of things at hand. You have your magazines and books and CDs, but he puts everything right down the middle of the bed and physically builds a wall between us.
In that clip from the documentary, Bree mentions that she's only had sex with her husband a few times. We'll learn why in another part of the movie.
You know, you see a guy who's paralyzed in a wheelchair, you think, oh, he's just in a wheelchair. You don't think about the, you know, stuff inside that's paralyzed. I can't cough because my stomach muscles are paralyzed, so I can't work up the full coughing energy. I'm more susceptible to urinary tract infections, and there's a great big erection sidebar to this whole story.
Hold the head of the penis between the thumb and the forefinger.
One of the more delightful side effects of my situation is erectile dysfunction, ED, and there are several choices out there on the market available to a young man with penis problems, and we've tried two or three of them, and they haven't really worked all that well for us. One that we haven't tried is this thing called the Caverject system, which involves a shot directly into your penis of some kind of magic medicine that'll give you an erection, but it still involves a needle into a very sensitive area.
Another way to try to awaken the monster is the pump. It's kind of like a vacuum tube thing, and you can watch your penis get larger. But it's not the most romantic thing in the world to bring this big hunk of plastic and rubber into bed.
This film is more than a story about a disabled veteran. It's about veterans who are actively fighting this war and how Thomas finds a home in Iraq Veterans Against the War. In this documentary, Bree tells a story of how Thomas becomes involved in the movement to end the war and fight for better care for veterans.
When Thomas came home from rehab, he was obviously focused on gaining as much independence as he could.
Go over and spot me.
But that doesn't give your life purpose. And so he felt pretty useless for a long time. He didn't get out of bed. He played PlayStation, watched movies, listened to music, read magazines. And he would watch the news, listen to Bush and Rumsfeld and everyone, and get so upset about all the lies that they were telling. And I really think that it was about the time that Cindy Sheehan was in Crawford that he realized it was important for him to speak out.
First of all, Thomas did not want Oh Lad, Poor Lad, How Sad movie. And it certainly isn't that. He wanted to make a statement. And so did I. I mean, I wanted this to be an anti-war film. And so did Thomas.
When we met Thomas, he wasn't evolved as an activist. He had anti-war bumper stickers, and he had a lot of thoughts in his head. So it was remarkable. Starting from right after his wedding day, he decided to go for his honeymoon in Crawford, Texas, because he wanted to speak to the president and ask him, why did you send me to Iraq? And I signed up for Afghanistan. And his story is Thomas finding his voice as an anti-war activist. It's the true story of an anti-war hero, Body of War.
As Thomas becomes involved in activism against the war, he begins to see hypocrisies everywhere, in almost every arena of politics.
If you consider a different issue, it goes right along with the George Bush doctrine on other issues. They're, say, for example, very pro-life and against abortion, but oddly enough, those children that are in poor situations, once they've been born, because abortion is frowned upon, the same Bush administration doesn't fund Head Start programs or help those mothers with their financial burdens. So when you look at it in a military perspective, we've always said that the Army and the military loves to have you in, which on some days that's kind of an iffy situation in itself. But once you get out, they really don't feel the need to take care of you as well. Actually, yesterday, the Congress, thanks to Senator Jim Webb, is debating a new GI bill, and it has heavy bipartisan support. Except the White House doesn't like it because, in their words, we cannot give our veterans too many incentives to want to leave the military. which basically, I'll admit, I'm prone to a bit of cynicism.
You're allowed.
Which means, in essence, they just want to keep sending the soldiers over and over and over again till I guess they, in essence, die and they don't have to concern themselves with that anymore. And they've talked to several senators who are against this bill, and apparently that's the only argument they have, is that we cannot make life so good for veterans that they want to get out.
It's madness.
It's absolutely madness, because we volunteer because we love the country and we wish to defend it and the Constitution. And all we're asking is that if we come home, we'd like opportunities to receive proper medical care, a place to live if necessary, if we need help with that, and the chance to get a good education. Because if you sign up at the age of 18, you give away a lot of your good college years to go serve your country, and it seems only fair that should be repaid back.
The movie's an intense critique of the Bush administration and of all the senators and congressmen who voted to give the president the authorization to go to war. It also criticizes another group of people, the media.
Those weapons of mass destruction got to be somewhere. Nope, no weapons over there. Maybe under here.
I said to him the other day, George, if you really want to end tyranny in the world, you're going to have to stay up later. Ladies and gentlemen, I am a desperate housewife.
But what does it say to the two of you, filmmaker, been in the media for a long, long time, to watch the White House Correspondents' Dinner and watch your colleagues laughing at that film while Americans and Iraqis are dying in Iraq?
You know,
what does it say to you?
I'm not going to pass judgment on
that. No, I didn't mean
that.
In the largest sense, what does it say about where we are?
It says, as Ellen said, they are isolated. They don't feel this war. This is the most sanitized war ever. We don't see the pain. That's one of the things that's motivated us to do this film. If you're going to send a nation to war? Show the sacrifice. Stop sanitizing the war. I mean, it's just, and the more I think about it, the more, you know, and I look at Thomas and I think of my president, you know, bring it on. Bring it on. There is no affect. This gang in the White House, radicals, by the way, they're privatizing in the war. Imagine. I had an uncle who fought in World War II. I can't imagine what he's thinking now. May he rest. We're going to have private people shooting civilians in a war? I thought that we believe that our film raises the curtain on another part of this war. I happen to think that President Bush and the people around him believe, you know, war happens. Isn't it a shame? But it happens. And it's sort of like, you know, we're expecting it to happen. And it's too bad and we're sorry about all those dead people, but war happens. I mean, there's no affect here. They don't seem to feel what these families are going through. Neither does most of the nation. These folks are under the radar. They're not seen. That's what we mean by a sanitized war.
Well, don't you think that was part of what we were talking about earlier about the White House correspondence dinner? I mean, that was about, looking at it for me, was saying that this is, the people in the media have gotten much too friendly with those they're supposed to be covering.
It's always that way. Power in the press in Washington has to do with your Rolodex. What we're looking for is journalists who don't care if the White House doesn't call them back. Journalists who aren't desperate to be popular. Journalism isn't supposed to be popular. Journalists are supposed to tell people what they don't want to hear. They're supposed to stick their nose under the tent to see what the righteous have in store for us. That's an inelegant thing to do. And it's hard to put that together with, you know, wanting to be popular and dine with the powerful. It's a very seductive thing. And by the way, the journalists will tell you, well, I got to have my sources. I've got to go to dinner. I've got otherwise. And that's true. But I think it's become more of a need to be seen in the company of these powerful people.
While this movie criticizes the media and President Bush, the real criticism is reserved for those people in Congress who voted in October 2002 to give President Bush the authorization to go to war in Iraq. Throughout the movie, we see C-SPAN coverage of the October 2002 debate. We see congressperson after congressperson standing up to give their testimony on why the country should go to war, parroting, repeating, and paraphrasing Bush administration talking points. The film's a direct condemnation of those people who marched to the drumbeat of war and abrogated their constitutional responsibilities as our representatives.
So when you put this film together, I was really kind of fascinated by how it was made, that when you did the roll calls, when you did all the kind of blatant lies that were told by Bush and then kind of mimicked by members of the Senate and the House, and the way you kind of intersperse that with the reality of what Thomas is living through. It was a really interesting choice, I thought.
Well, that was all Phil's decision, and he painstakingly watched and edited hundreds of hours of material into this incredible expose. Mm-hmm. So in addition to this personal, heartfelt story of Thomas and his family and their journey, we have this expose of how this whole thing was scripted. And nobody's telling you. You're just seeing it on the screen. The evidence was out there, but it was so many hours of material that very few people watched all of the C-SPAN footage. But Phil Donahue is one of the few people that did watch it all and saw these little connections. And when you put them all together, you see the script.
So when we see and hear the roll call and all the kind of mimicry of everything Bush said by the other senators, and talk about that experience for you, Phil. I mean, first of all, the tediousness of the work itself, but what was happening to you as you were watching this unfold, as you were figuring it out?
The hysteria of it. Ted Stevens of Alaska. The history will show.
Read that the nations who stood together and stopped Saddam Hussein
saved the world. Stuff like this. John Warner. Saddam Hussein
possesses today an arsenal of weapons far, far more dangerous to the whole world than Hitler ever possessed.
John McCain.
Each day that goes by, he becomes more dangerous,
more diabolical.
Every day, Saddam Hussein grows stronger.
His capabilities become better.
Every day, Saddam Hussein builds more chemical and biological weapons.
The longer we wait, the more dangerous he becomes.
You can hear the breathing and the heavy breathing and the acceleration of the heartbeat. War, war.
He has aflatoxin. And he has ricin toxin.
The Ebola virus.
Smallpox virus.
Smallpox has about a 30% mortality.
Wheat cover smut, which can be used to poison crops.
VX, sarin.
Sarin, VX, Tabin.
You can put them in a bottle this small.
He's got 22,500.
And by the way, every major metropolitan newspaper in this country supported this war. And it's important to know how hard it was to vote no in October 2002. And by the way, This thing took place, this debate in Congress took place 3 weeks before an election.
The rush to say to the president, go it alone. Don't worry about anybody else. I think it's hurting this debate, and I think that this debate looks political.
3 weeks before election seems to be an odd time to be authorizing war.
I urge you to oppose this rush to war. It is morally wrong, financially irresponsible, and it's not in our national security interest. We have options, and we have an obligation to pursue them.
That's what the point Byrd makes. You know, this will be a blot, he says, on the Congress and the executive forever to send men and women into harm's way on a political vote that may bring them home dead or harmed.
In the name of the young men and women whose lives may be put on the line by the decision that this Senate will make is too weighty, is too far-reaching, and it's only fair to the people of America who are going to be asked to give, in some instances, everything they've got, everything they have, if a war ensues. And I tell you, my friends, I don't want that on my conscience. Not I.
I mean, he was eloquent. He's begging his colleagues, please hold it. Slow down. Wait a minute. And he lost. 23. He was only able to. 23 senators voted no. 133 members of the House voted no. This resolution passed easily. And by the way, it wasn't constitutional. And this point is made in our film. We're very proud of the part of our film that celebrates the United States Constitution.
We can save a lot of space, we can save a lot of paper, if we want to pass this 9-page document by cutting it down to one sentence. The president is authorized to use the armed services of the United States for as long as he wants, wherever he wants, in any manner he wants, without any approval by Congress, as long as he determines it is necessary to defend against a threat posed by Iraq in his own determination. That's all. This is an abdication of our responsibility. Here it is. What a shame. What a rag.
Isn't that something? How radical is that idea? Only Congress can declare war. And Byrd makes the point. James Madison said it's too much of a temptation to give to one man.
As James Madison wrote, in no part of the Constitution is more wisdom to be found than in the clause which confides the question of war or peace to the legislature and not to the executive department. The trust and the temptation would be too great for any one man. That was James Madison. The trust and the temptation would be too great for any one man.
Don't give one man the army, the navy, and all the things that go boom. He will use them. You need the collective wisdom of the Congress. And Congress hasn't declared a war in the constitutional sense since the early 40s.
So, again, though, when you were doing this, did you understand what was going on in the U.S. Congress and how that Iraq group in the White House, with the WIG, the White House.
White House Iraq group, yeah.
How they orchestrated all this with the senators and congressmen, were you aware of that before you did this film?
No, well, I got smart. I'm a slow learner. But the more you watched it, you realized there were echoes here. And then suddenly, even I got it, you know? These people were reading these White House talking points.
The smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
When there is a smoking gun or a mushroom cloud, we have waited too long.
We cannot wait for the smoking gun. A gun smokes only after it has been fired.
The gun smokes only after it is fired.
A gun smokes after it's been fired.
That smoking gun would be a smoking city.
And the smoke of a nuclear blast would mean that we are too late.
A smoking gun will become a mush. A gun smokes after it's been fired. A gun smokes after 3-4 people. This was the most superficial bumper sticker debate imaginable.
And to see them try to add their little conversational flourishes to make it seem like their own original thought instead of something that came from Puppet Master Cheney's mouth, including some from my own personal side of the aisle, one of which is actually running for president, just resounding on George Bush talking point after talking point.
Discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles.
Unmanned aerial vehicles.
Unmanned aerial vehicles.
UAVs.
Unmanned aerial vehicles.
Small unmanned aerial vehicles.
That is to say, model airplanes.
That could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas.
Capable of delivering chemical and biological warfare agents.
Across broad areas.
Over wide territory.
It hurts me as a human being to have to watch those things. And but I do notice that when I have had to watch the movie, which I try not to do very much anymore, I'll admit, you see this first wave of I voters, all these, and then you're getting there. And every time I watch the movie, I'm like a kid watching his favorite movie and waiting to quote the parts. I'm just sitting there waiting for Robert Byrd to thrust his constitution in the air and go, wait!
Slow down!
Don't rush this through this and go through. Off on some of his fiery orations, which were just amazing to watch, that in the midst of an election, even, when he could have potentially lost his seat, although personally, even though I'm not a member of his constituency, anybody that that lives in, I believe, West Virginia, that tries to run against him would just be, considered laughable. But to watch him argue about doing this 3 weeks before an election was just inane. And then to actually get to meet him at the end of the film, it was within 5 minutes of our conversation, I wanted to ask him to adopt me as a grandson. He's an amazing person to talk to. He's been there for so long. 48 years. To think about the votes he has cast to change the way the course of America is taken is just incomprehensible. You don't see congressmen and orators like him anymore that are willing to stand up in the face of such great opposition for what they actually believe in. That is truly an amazing man who believes in the power of our government to do great things.
If Robert Byrd had been successful in stopping or slowing down this vote for war, Thomas Young would be walking today. I believe that.
The documentary film Body of War ends as Senator Robert Byrd and Thomas Young meet. We too will end this story with Robert Byrd and listen to an excerpt of a speech to the Senate he gave in October 2002.
My hands tremble, but my heart still throbs.
I read this quote. Naturally, the common people don't want war. But after all, it is the leaders of a country who determine the policy. And it is always a simple matter to drag the people along. Whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship, or a parliament or a communist dictatorship, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for a lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in every country. Hermann Göring, president of the Reichstag Nazi Parliament, 1934.
I speak for a man who gave for this land, took a bullet in the back for his pain, spilled his blood in the dirt and the dust, and he's come back to say what he has seen is hard to believe, and it does no good to just pray. All he asked of us to stand and we must in this war today.
Thank you for listening to the special production from the Center for Emerging Media. Learn more about the documentary film Body of War at the film's website, www.bodyofwar.com. We've got videos and links and more for you on our website at www.centerforemergingmedia.com. This podcast was produced by Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. And we thank Clean Cuts Music and Sound Design for studio space and technical assistance. And special thanks to our engineer, Devin Murphy. And from the Center for Emerging Media, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
Nothing's too good for a veteran. Yeah, this is what they say. So nothing is what they will get in this new American way. The lies that were told to get us to go, war criminal, let us be straight. Yeah, let's get to the point where our voices are heard.